taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And tonight we have a special guest. We have former council member William Lightfoot. Bill Lightfoot was a two-term at-large council member in the District of Columbia, and he remains active in politics. He's chaired 8 mayoral campaigns, and he continues to serve on the D.C. Judicial Tenure and Disabilities Commission that reappoints and disciplines judges. He also runs his own law firm here in Washington as a top litigator. Thanks so much for being with us tonight, council member.
Thank you. It is my honor to be on with Senator Brown. Man, I'm excited. Thank you very much.
Well, let me tell you something. I've trained candidates. I've gotten awards for this. I've trained candidates all across the country to run for public office. And one thing that we always tell candidates when they start a political campaign is to find the 5 to 10 important people in their community that are connected to the political structure and talk to them before you do anything. And in Washington, D.C., one of those people is Bill Lightfoot. Everybody that runs for public office in the District of Columbia understands that this is a man you can consult, should consult. Now, you told me that your record on mayoral campaigns was 5-2-1. And what I'd really like to know is how you have a tie. 5 wins,
sure.
I understand. 2 losses. I've had 2 losses, so I understand that too. But what's a tie? How do you get a tie?
Back in 1994, I was an independent D.C. council member at large. And I decided to run for mayor at that point in time. And I said that I would run against the winner of the primary between a Democratic primary between Marion Barry, Sharon Kelly, and John Ray. Well, of course, Marion did win the primary. So now, and I qualified for the ballot. I had a campaign organization. I collected my signatures, submitted all my material. My name was going to be on the ballot. And then I decided to withdraw for various reasons, most of which were personal. So the fact that I was running my own campaign and then I withdrew from the campaign, I consider that a tie. That's how I got my one mayoral tie. No. Now, other than that, of course, I have been actively engaged in 7 mayoral campaigns as the chairperson of the campaign itself.
And you've done an amazing job. You've gotten some important people elected in the District of Columbia. I mean, everybody that gets elected to the position of mayor is pretty important, but you've really had some watershed candidates too. Most recently, our current mayor, Muriel Bowser, who's only the 2nd woman mayor that we've ever had in the District of Columbia and has been overwhelmingly reelected every time she's run since her original election. Right now, let's start there with her briefly. There's a new budget out. There are critics. Of course, there are always critics, right? You can't be in. I don't care if Joan of Arc was the candidate, there would be critics out there. But there are critics of the new budget a little bit. Reduction to money in the housing trust fund, and something that might be close to your heart, and that's a reduction in money going to violence interfering, what they call violence interferers. You've resurrected a thing called the Thou Shalt Not Kill campaign because of the uptick in recent murders, I assume, in the District of Columbia. And this is something you started back in 1992 when there were 460 homicides. Oh, my God. I remember those days. So how do you feel about the new budget? Have you looked at it? Do you have any sense of it?
Yes, on the budget, I have looked at it. And, in fact, I spent some time looking at the mayor's presentation to the council. Mayor Bowser presented her budget on Friday to the city council, and I thought she had a very good, informative, back-and-forth take between her and the council members, and I would encourage anyone to watch it as I did. I will say I was very proud of the way she handled herself, and I was proud of the council members as well for the questions that they asked. Clearly, we're having a difficult time financially, nothing like when we had the control board back in the 90s, but, you know, we've got a projected deficit of $1.7 billion, over the next several years. We've just come off the pandemic, and we have received a large amount of federal money, which helped us get through the pandemic. But now, of course, we no longer get that money, so now we've got to back that money out of the budget. In addition to that, our people are suffering from the pandemic. We know that we've got mental health problems, financial problems. People can't afford their rent. People lost their jobs. And, of course, downtown has been devastated by the vacancies. So there are many after effects and consequences from the pandemic that this budget must address, but at the same time move our city forward to invest in what I call our human capital, our people, our young people, children below the ages of, you know, 3 before they can go to school, after school programs. And all of that was covered in the budget on Friday, and I thought very well.
Well, you know, what a difficult position to be in, to have to make those choices. And, you know, as you said, as you pointed out, the $1.5 billion from the federal government, it really puts us in a peculiar position as a jurisdiction, does it not? That we have to depend on the federal government for so much. But in the meantime, you've got guys out there like me that are fighting with the federal government so that we can be independent. It's sort of, or so that we can have representation at the federal level. It's a real balancing act. But let me ask you, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, nobody knows our unique status better than you do, you know, our shadow senator, and how difficult it is to operate as a city with an overseer sitting in the Capitol, you know, just in the center of our geographical area. And those people that control the city, the congressmen, they really have very little connection to us and do not understand our city. But yes, despite our unique position, which gives us benefits, let's be honest about it, there are some benefits and there are some downsides. But having said that, overall, I think that Mayor Bowser, certainly Congresswoman Norton, you and your delegation of the shadow up on the hill have done a fabulous job maintaining an element of autonomy, at least until the time we had this most recent criminal code that got overturned by the Congress.
Yeah, that was, you know, I got to say, in my humble opinion, that was a colossal mistake by the city council. And, you know, I've talked to two, back to Mayor Bowser, I've talked to two council members since then, and one of them actually had the audacity to blame it on her. One of them said to me, well, if she just let it alone and hadn't made a big deal about it, it would have passed. And what I thought to myself is, oh, my God, is this how we legislate? We sneak things up on the hill and hope nobody notices? I mean, in my humble opinion, the mayor tried to fix this before it went up to the hill. And
well, she did. And let's be clear, the fight on the council, at least, was on substance. The mayor's veto of this crime bill was based upon recommendations from the chief of police She vetoed it based upon the recommendations from the chief judge, and their opposition to it was because they felt it would make the city less safe. And the mayor agreed, and I agree with the mayor. So that, you know, again, you talk about I've been on the council. I served on the council from 1988 to 1996. And for four of those years, I chaired the Council Judiciary Committee. And at that time, we were dealing with the crack cocaine epidemic. We were the murder capital of the nation. 500 people a year were being killed and murdered. You know, we talk about murders today in the low 200s. It's terrible to have any murders. But to have 200 compared to the 500 we had back then is a huge difference. And we passed legislation back in the 90s, much of which I was a sponsor of, the criminal justice reforms, that clearly made a difference. And this criminal code that was being passed by the council undid some very significant provisions that helped us lower the murder rate from 500 to 200. So I think the mayor was correct in vetoing it. The council should have worked with her. And I think the council will work with it as we go forward. We will still accomplish some of the goals of the criminal code to update the antiquated language in our criminal code. But some of the more substantive policy changes, such as on sentencing or such as with the non-jury misdemeanor trials, or even having a strong police force, I think those changes are not going to – I think we're going to stay strong in those areas, but yet amend the technical parts of the law that need to be changed.
Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I agree with the mayor, too, but I agree with the mayor on a different basis, and that was on the basis of politics, that it was bad optics to send a bill that made the changes that you talked about in some of the minimum sentencing requirements, for example, up to this ultra-conservative group that's using as their platform against the Democrats soft on crime. They're beating the drum about crime, and it just seemed ridiculous to me. It seemed myopic. I actually called the council petulant children because it reminded me of my teenagers who used to do things that where they couldn't see past the end of their nose. You know, they couldn't see what the consequences of their actions were. That's why you have to keep an eye on them until they're fully grown. But I disagree because of the – I agree with the mayor because I thought the optics were bad, and they were. We lost 65 Democrats, 31 in the House, and 30 we actually lost 64 and 33 in the Senate. First time ever. And now these guys, I don't know that you can fix the crime bill because I don't think that they much care about the specifics of the crime bill. Obviously, anything that's 100 years old probably needs renovation. But I think they care most about a fight with the District of Columbia for political reasons, for pushing their agenda. So I'm not sure that we can fix it and send it up there.
I think you're absolutely correct about the politics of it. And the city council was tone deaf. You know, you earlier talked about the unique status of our city, and we have to recognize that we are basically a colony, so we've got to be aware of what our masters in the big house are thinking, and the council just ignored that. But having said that, there were some very substantive changes that I think were meaningful, which would actually affect the criminal activity in the district. And I'm going to name two, starting with the one that I think was, to me, the most important, and one that I brought about to change when I was on the city council. And that is the change for misdemeanors to be non-jury trials. That's what we passed back in the 90s, and now it's being reversed. The council wanted to say that all misdemeanors would now go to a jury trial. And the chief judge of the court wrote a very strong letter condemning that, talking about how it would tie up the court because there'd be so many jury trials and we wouldn't be able to get the kind of services to the people that need them. And I will tell you, back in the 90s, this was equally controversial. At that point in time, we did allow jury trials for many, many, many misdemeanors. And then I sponsored legislation. We changed that law so that we reduced the time period for certain offenses and then made those misdemeanors non-jury trials. And the reason we did that in part was not only to clear up the backlog of the court so that judges and prosecutors could devote their time to serious crimes, felonies, murders, you know, armed offenses, but also so that we could divert people out of the system. With the judges out of the criminal justice system, with a non-jury misdemeanor trial, we have been able to develop what are called problem-solving courts. And these problem-solving courts are drug courts. They're mental health courts. They have a court they call the father court because so many of these young people, and many of them are young people, they don't have parental guidance. So the thought was with non-jury misdemeanors, the judges could get involved in these, the lives of the accused, coordinate services to help them, whether it's drug treatment or mental health treatment or job assistance. And then with the completion of the program, the criminal charges would not be pursued and there wouldn't be a criminal record for the person. And there is a study that's posted on the Superior Court website that anyone who's interested, I'd recommend they take a look at it. It's public information. It's a study back then, I think it was 2012, that found that these problem-solving courts relying upon the non-jury misdemeanors have significantly reduced the level of recidivism. That is, those people that complete our problem-solving courts, they are much less likely to commit another crime than someone does not go through that process. So I say that that was one element of what the council did, which was detrimental to public safety. And the other one I'd like to address quickly, if I could, is this sentencing, the idea that we had these long and harsh sentences. And I understand it looks harsh. And back in the 90s, again, myself, I was one of the sponsors of this legislation, but it was based upon my understanding of the criminal mentality. People who commit crimes have a different mentality than you or me, Michael, or probably the people that are listening. And one of the things I learned is I rode with the police officers. I visited a D.C. jail. I went out to Lorton. You know, I'd sit in the court proceedings and watch some of these criminal trials. Criminals have a saying, and the saying is, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. If you can't do the time, don't do the crime. So we want these criminals to believe that if they commit a harsh offense, they're going to face very serious consequences. And I will say those changes combined with other reforms, I do believe made a significant difference in reducing the homicide rate from 500 to 200, although now it's starting to creep up again above 200.
Well, and I've heard other people make that same those same comments, other legal professionals make those same comments, Bill. And I think that, you know, one thing that I read in the Post, again, back to my comment about they were, you know, they were oblivious to the politics involved, you know, is that some guy listed all the legal professionals that had worked on this. And all I could think of is they should have had one politician. They should have one politician to say, hey, this may not be the right time. And one statistic that really blew me away was that somebody said that this thing about the jury trials, demanding jury trials, could increase the fact that you have jury duty once every 2 years in the District of Columbia. It could change it to twice a year. Now, I got to tell you, I can't believe that the people of the District of Columbia, I've never, in 35 years of living here, I've never once heard anybody say, gee, I wish I could go to jury duty more often. You know, I really don't, right? I don't think that you know, I had a friend that used to say, wear a big cross and carry a Bible, and they won't choose you for the jury. You know, we used to discuss tactics to get out of our civic responsibility. But yeah,
well, yeah, let me just say, serving on the jury is an honor. And it is probably the most important function that we perform as citizens. In fact, I think it is one of the few, if not the only requirement in the Constitution that we as citizens must perform. You must serve on duty, and jury duty. Having said that, again, this goes back to what you said earlier. The council members were really kind of tone deaf and just weren't thinking politically, and they weren't thinking in the real world. They were thinking more along the lines of academics or, you know, theoreticians. Right. They didn't realize that we have a very difficult time getting people to come to jury service even now. before you make them go to trials and sit on jury trials for misdemeanors. I chaired a study several years ago from the Council on Court Excellence, and it was all about jury service because we recognized many people weren't coming to serve on juries. Even though it is a very important obligation, it keeps our country running. It truly does equalize everybody. No matter whether you're poor, rich, black or white, Latino, it doesn't matter. Everybody's entitled to a fair day in court, and a jury helps with that. But if you're going to help citizens who've committed these misdemeanors, which are really, in many of them, they're low-level crimes, they're quality-of-life crimes, we don't want to incarcerate them. We don't want to have some jury trial tying up resources. We want to help those people who've committed this aberrant behavior, this unusual behavior, the abnormal behavior. We want to provide service to them so they can change their behavior. And that's what we have been doing with the non-jury misdemeanors as they serve as a foundation for our problem-solving courts.
Yeah, well, I've been before the court. I sat in, I blocked traffic in front of the Senate in protest, and I went to trial, and I didn't have a jury trial, and the judge told me that I was his hero because he admired people that stood up for what they believed in, and then he found me guilty. He said, even heroes can't sit in the damn street and block traffic. So, and Anise Jenkins, who you might know is an activist, she's been arrested 8 times in civil disobedience stuff. And she had jury trials and she always got off. And I used to say, oh, my God, 8 arrests and no convictions. That automatically qualifies you to be governor of New Jersey, which is my home state, you know. But so,
yeah. Well, yeah, let me just say, for political protests like you were engaged in or April was engaged in, we don't have the same need to get services to you. Right. But for the drug offender who, you know, is selling a small amount of drugs on the street, or the mental health person, you know, urinates on the bus or, you know, spits on the sidewalk or, you know, lays down in the middle of the street, those people need help. And it's not about taking them to trial. That's not going to help them. What we need is somebody who's in a position of authority, like a judge, who cares enough about them to see that they get the resources of the city to them and they can improve their lives without a criminal record. If I can switch back to something you mentioned a moment ago. You asked about how I felt about the thou shalt not kill message resurrecting itself. That really started from Sam Ford, the TV commentator, Channel 7. Again, back in the 90s, I spent my own money, and I bought a couple thousand of those thou shalt not kill signs, which is a biblical verse. It's one of the Ten Commandments. And I put those up around the city, and people remembered those. And now, 30 years later, about 5 or 6 months ago, I was talking to Sam, and he was cleaning out his closet. And he told me that when he cleaned out a closet, he found one of those old thou shalt not kill signs. And he did a show on it and said, maybe we should put these signs back up again. And Phil Pinnell, who's an activist in Ward 8, and he's the executive director of the Anacostia Coordinating Council, Phil saw Sam's show, and Phil called me up and said, Bill, would you be willing to put these signs up again? And then I started working. So he and I started working with Andy Shalal of Busboys and Poets, and we bought some of those signs and put them up, primarily in Ward 8 along Martin King Avenue, Southern Avenue, I believe. We had them up during the Martin Luther King Parade. And, you know, it's something that reminds people that we really have to treat life as something sacred. And there are words that have powerful meaning. And words in the Bible do have a meaning. And this is a biblical saying, thou shalt not kill, which we have found resonates. And it helps people. It inspires people. It buoys people. It gives them energy to do something about the crime in our neighborhoods. Much like many years ago, we had what we call the Orange Hat Patrol, the Citizens Patrols. Little more boots on the ground idea, but the same idea of citizens getting involved to fight the crime in our city.
Well, we certainly need that. And, you know, you're talking to the sign king. I mean, I put up 800 signs when Obama was inaugurated saying statehood, yes, we can. I put up billboards at the paid $10,000 to put up billboards at the Democratic convention when they took statehood out of the platform and they put it back in next time. People don't understand, I think, how a simple act like putting up a sign, the kind of impact it can actually have. I have a warning sign. You know, my house is the first house you come to when you come into the District of Columbia. So I have a warning sign that's as big a sign as I could get from a billboard company that makes stop signs and stuff that says, warning, you're entering the District of Columbia. Residency here may result in a loss of your basic civil rights.
I didn't know that was your sign or your house, but I know exactly what you're talking about. You're on the circle up there at Western Avenue, Mass Avenue, I think.
Exactly. We're Western Avenue.
Yeah, that's a great sign. My wife and I love it. Every time we go around that circle, we comment on it.
Well, you're right.
I mean, words have meaning.
Yes.
We know this. And it is part of how we change people's lives. It's messaging. We as politicians always talk about a message. Have a vision. Convey your vision by giving your message. Stay on message. And putting up a sign like you did about warning coming into D.C. where you don't have elected official, or the signs like we have put up about thou shalt not kill, people remember that in part because it's visual. It's not only auditory. You know, people learn many different ways. And they learn. And if you can show them as something and teach them something and using different mediums, it's more likely for them those words will stick in their memory and they'll take appropriate action.
Well, and you know, we have these guys on Capitol Hill that are continuing to pursue their political agenda, and they're now moving on to the Reform and Policing Act, and they called up our chairman of our council and council member from Ward 6, Charles Allen, to, you know, basically be called in front of them for, I assume, to be eviscerated on Wednesday. We'll see. But, you know, we've had, it's almost like the perfect storm happening, Councilman. We had five young people killed last week. It was horrible. We had five murders between Monday and Friday of kids between the ages of 17 and 24. So we have crime on the uptick, like most major cities after the pandemic. Of course, they never mention like most major cities. And it seems like the perfect storm, and these guys want to make the District of Columbia their whipping boy.
They're going to do that? Oh, and exactly. Listen, they invited Phil, the chairperson. They've invited Charles Allen, our Ward 6 council member.
Right.
But they and both of those were very staunch supporters of the criminal code revisions. They got vetoed by the mayor and rejected by Congress. Congress did not invite the mayor.
Right.
Congress did not invite the chief of police. So clearly these congressmen, they intend to put on a show, performance politics we talk about. And Phil and Charles Allen have to be very careful that they don't play into this theater and show. Because if Phil and Charles Allen get up there and try and defend all that stuff that's in the criminal code, all they're going to do is make themselves more of a spectacle and show how out of touch they are with the reality of the world that we live in. And that's my greatest fear. And let's face it, if this continues with Congress acting with this performance politics and beating up on the district, and Republicans get some traction out of it, they will keep going. And you wonder what's going to be next. If it's the crime code, the criminal code was first, police reform will be second. What's next? It could be the stadium at RFK, the stadium over there on Hill East that's been tied up for so long. Who knows? We may find that the National Football League wants a stadium there, and they've got support in Congress to put the stadium there, and it won't matter what the mayor and the city council chairman say. Congress will put the stadium right there.
Well, and you know what? This is what spurred them to move on to the Reform and Policing Act, is that they were successful. They were remarkably successful. They got 65 Democrats. I mean, when was the last time you heard of 65 Democrats agreeing with the Republicans? And
they even got the President of the United States. Absolutely.
They pushed them into a corner. Yeah. They pushed them into a corner. And, you know, there's activists out there, Bill, that are attacking the president for saying that he wouldn't veto it. And all I can think to myself is, do these people really think that President DeSantis or President Trump is going to be more likely to make them a state than President Biden? I mean, you know, you're right. We have to stand up for the people that represent us, and we need to because D.C. is going to have a hard way to go. We're the perfect.
And I will say, I bought a full page ad in the Washington Informer 2 weeks ago. And I did it because I do believe it's important that we stand up for our politicians and we stand up for home rule and our right for self-determination. And the headline in the ad that I paid for in the Informer, it said, Congress should respect the D.C. Council's right to be wrong. Yeah. Congress should respect the D.C. Council's right to be wrong, meaning I recognize the council was wrong. I recognize what they did was dangerous. But nonetheless, as a principle of democracy, where we believe that our elected officials should have some autonomy and have the power to represent the voters, that if you really believe in democracy, you've got to believe in a legislator's right to be wrong. And they were wrong in this. But Phil and Charles really need to recognize that there are aspects of this bill that have legitimate concerns that we on a local level are not, we're not about politics on this. This is a matter of substance. And when you read that committee report that came out of the council, it lacked a lot of substance. It talked about things in other parts of the country, but it said very little about the unique situation about crime in the District of Columbia. It said almost nothing about what I call our problem courts, which our court calls the problem-solving courts. It really didn't talk about the sentencing guidelines other than talk about what's in other jurisdictions. It said nothing about our efforts to increase truancy rules as well as parental accountability and requiring people to go to parenting classes. So that criminal code revision, that committee report, it may have been fine for the academics and the academicians and the theorists, but it really had almost no connection to what happens in the city and did not talk about how crime has grown in the city, what controlled the crime after the crack epidemic, what worked and didn't work. You don't read that in that council report, and that's what I fault them for. It really was a lack of rigorous thought and analysis.
Yeah, and you know what? We're talking about the crime bill now, but wait till these guys move on. The other bill they set up there was a citizen voting bill. And I understand, again, the mentality behind that, except that they included, unfortunately, Charles Allen, again, our council six councilmen, included undocumented aliens. Now, these guys are going to have a field day with that. For 2 years, they've been saying that the election results in California and Arizona should be overturned because thousands and thousands of illegal aliens voted in those elections, which we know is not true. But it seems that we're playing right into their narrative by including them. So they've got a lot to work with.
We definitely are playing into their narrative. I mean, John, talk about a setup. That's horrible. Well, it's like, what were they thinking about? They weren't thinking. On the other hand, let me just say, too, in our politics today, we have extremes on the right and we have extremes on the left.
Yes, we do.
And this idea that, you know, undocumented workers should be voting in our elections is more of an idea on our extreme left. The extreme right's got their own ideas, but this is an extreme leftist idea. And they slipped it in this bill. But frankly, it wasn't just slipped in. This is something that we've got a Working Families Party here, which I know you know about,
right,
which is like a separate party working inside the Democratic Party in the District of Columbia. And they have been trending over the years to become more and more extreme leftists. That's an internal political fight that we have inside the District of Columbia, which is now going to spill over as you see Congress attack more and more the legislation we pass on the council, such as this right for non-documented workers to vote.
And, you know, the council, now that you bring that up, they have been moved, been pushed by these people and others like them. They've considered just incredible things like allowing 16-year-olds to vote. Now, we don't allow 16-year-olds to drive cars by themselves. We don't allow them to drive cars by themselves. They have to have somebody in the car with them. But we're going to let them go in the voting booth and vote? I mean, it's just... It seems like such a leftist idea. And, you know, I will admit, as a guy that's been a Democrat for 40 years, what you said is so true, and we don't recognize it as liberals very often. We see the right-wing people, the conservative people in America, as being extreme, but we don't see any extremists on our side. And,
yeah,
and,
but there are definitely extremists on our side. And let me just say, the extremism, it's ideological.
Yep.
It's they don't think about the practical consequences of what they're doing. And in legislation, one thing you learn is there are unintended consequences. We pass a law, and we think that the citizens are going to act one way, and lo and behold, they act a different way. We have unintended consequences. But if you're a pragmatic legislator, if you're someone who's more of a moderate, you look at both sides of an argument and you figure out how it's going to happen in the real world. But we have people, some of whom are on the council, some of them now try and influence the council. They don't think that way. They think about their theory. They think about an ideology. And then they try and get the ideology enacted regardless of the consequences.
Yeah, and you know, another thing that people don't realize, I think, is that as an elected official, you're expected to get something done. You can be an activist and be a purist and say, you know, if Joe Biden doesn't stand up for this, damn it, I'm never going to vote for him again. But if you're a politician, you have to, you know, people expect you to get something done. They don't expect you to spend all your time in the ivory tower. They expect you to come down and make the trains run on time, right? That's something that
politics is the art of the possible, right? Politics is the art of the possible. What can we accomplish? You know, when we all remember, I think, what happened when Ralph Nader stayed in that presidential race and cost the Democrats the presidential election, okay? People voted for him. He was a good guy. He is a good guy. He had many great thoughts, but he was operating as a purist, not thinking about the practical consequences. And that's what happens when you do that. We live in a big world with a lot of people out here with a lot of ideas, and we have to take the long view. I will say, you know, going back to what you said a little while ago, talking about the budget before the council right now, the difference that I see between the mayor and the council members right now, the mayor is trying to develop a long-term strategy over the next several years that will undo the bad effects of the pandemic, take the lessons we've learned from the pandemic, which might be good, and at the same time recognize that things like revitalizing downtown is going to take several years to now accomplish, so we've got that long-term strategy. Whereas I listened to the debate on the budget with her and the council members, they all seem to be more immediate right now. We need to give people free vouchers right now. We need to give them, you know, something else free right now. The buses right now. It's got to be free. Well, I think that it reminds me of the old proverb that if you give a man a fish, you'll feed him for a day. If you teach a man to fish, you'll feed him for a lifetime. And I think we have got to recognize that we're trying to prepare our citizens for a lifetime of prosperity, not just something that happens in 2023 or 2024.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And unfortunately, again, the mayor, you know, she will be held responsible for how far the city, you know, how far the city goes in the next couple of years. And she's going to, you know, we're going to just have our hands full with repelling the attacks from these guys on Capitol Hill, I believe. I believe that, you know, what they're going to do is they're going to say, look, thank God we intervened to save the nation's capital from itself. And we can do the same thing for America. As long as we can get rid of these liberal, crazy Democrats, you know, that are trying to change everything. And I think as liberals, very often we don't understand that there are people out there buy this stuff so easily.
Oh yeah, let me just say one of the I think is a serious errors that you've just brought out is this view that those of us that consider ourselves progressive or want to help people in the Democratic Party, well, we really don't realize how extreme some of these Republicans are and how much harm they want to do. For example, and therefore some people talk about defunding the police. The only thing that saved this nation on January the 6th was the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. Yeah. Our police department saved the country on that day. Yes, they were real heroes. They were courageous. They battled. They battled for our democracy. And yet people still don't want to fund them to the level that they need to be funded, not just to fight street crimes, but those people that came to our Capitol on January the 6th, they plan on coming back again. And when they come back, are we going to have a strong police force to repel them? We all need to think about that now. And unfortunately, I don't think that some of our elected officials are thinking that way, although certainly the Republicans in the Hill must be thinking that way when they go to the jail to glorify the very criminals that we have locked up for trying to take over our country.
Well, there's no way to make sense of some of this stuff, Bill, that they want to protect our children from TikTok, but they don't want to protect them from AR-15 rifles. You know, yeah. I mean, it's just crazy that, and again, I think you're right. I think as liberals, we very often don't take into account how conservative, how destructive these people want to be. You know, I was one of those people. I say this all the time. The one thing about Donald Trump, the one positive thing about Donald Trump getting elected is that my family no longer asked for my political opinion. Because people from all over the country, I've been involved in six presidential campaigns, and people from all over the country, my family called me in about Trump, and I said, don't be crazy. Nobody's going to vote for this guy. There's no way he can get elected. Yeah. Right? It was a real wake-up call for so many of us that there's so many of the people out there, and we've allowed ourselves to be painted with this brush where, you know, when I started in politics, I started working for Jimmy Carter, and I had to deal with people like Jerry Falwell, who painted the Democratic Party as un-Christian, you know, we were godless. And I work for this guy who's 97 years old now and is still teaching Sunday school, you know, God bless them. But they were able to tar us with that brush. And that's a problem that I've seen. I've visited 17 states. And, you know, unfortunately, we have an image problem in Washington, D.C. A lot of people look at us like we all work for the IRS. You know,
let me just say, there's no doubt we have an image problem, and people around the country have a skewed view of what happens here in the city.
Yeah.
Those of us that live here, we love it. And we love it because that great people, and I really do think our best days are ahead of us. As I listened to Muriel talk the other day, and it got me to thinking about what's it going to take to revitalize downtown. It's probably never going to be the same as it used to be with all these commuters coming downtown to work from 9 to 5, okay? Right. But what we do have and what you can see already is people flocking to the city because we have great neighborhoods. And people love to live in this city in the neighborhoods they live in, whether it's Anacostia or Brooklyn or, you know, around the ballpark area. We've got so many great neighborhoods that you can walk to. The parks that we have, the museums that we have, the restaurants and the clubs, and people in D.C. really are quite friendly. So it is true that people outside the nation's capital may think that we are warped and ungodly, but those of us who live in the city, I think that we have a very bright, optimistic future, and something very much to look forward to.
Well, I agree with you. I've raised three children here, and, you know, the opportunities that they had were just amazing. My daughter was an amateur dancer who ended up at the centerfold in a magazine with Michelle Obama, because a national magazine with Michelle Obama, because the First Lady did a dance program at the White House, and she got a, you know, she got a bunch of kids who dance locally to come to the White House and dance for her. You know, you don't get opportunities like that if you live in the middle of Missouri or Iowa.
If you live in other big cities, they don't have that kind of opportunity. You know, I'm always amazed now to look at the Washington Post on Friday, and they have that Weekender section in there.
Uh-huh.
That thing is huge, and all it talks about is cultural events and things to do and see and go to and places to eat and shows to entertain you and places to have fun with. And that's on a Friday that it broadcasted, and there's so many things in there you can't even do all of them. And we didn't used to be that way. We weren't a cultural scene like that. We used to be a sleepy southern town.
Yeah.
But now we are a destination city. And for example, say what you want, but man, if you go down to the wharf on a Friday or Saturday night, those people down there are happy. They're clearly having a good time. There's a very diverse group. Everything is new. There are bright lights. It makes you feel good. It's a wonderful time to be here. It's a wonderful, wonderful time to be alive. And if I may, look at our schools. You and I have been around long enough to remember when you'd walk by past the rec center, a basketball court, and the hoops would even be on the backboards.
Right.
Now, we have renovated, I think, 24 out of 26 libraries. Every school in the city has had a major renovation. Rec centers have been renovated. It used to be you want to go out into the suburbs because you thought their parks and rec centers were better than ours. Not anymore. By no means. Our schools are better physically than anybody's schools almost anywhere else in the country. Our rec centers are the envy of places in other parts of the country. And our library system is one of the best in the world. We didn't have that 10 years ago, but we've got it now, and it's only getting better.
Well, you know, people have to recognize that Washingtonians are special people, too. You know, imagine we couldn't even vote for president. Lyndon Johnson was the first guy we voted for president. We couldn't vote prior to 1961. But our parents, my dad, maybe your dad, a lot of dads, went off and fought in the Second World War. They fought to defend America when they couldn't even vote for president. And we serve at higher than the national average. We pay the most in federal income taxes. The people in the District of Columbia are committed, and they're patriotic. They're good Americans, and I think sometimes that doesn't get across.
But it doesn't get across, but it gets across to those of us that live here. We know we love our country. We love our city. We love our monuments. We love so much about America. And we're always proud and happy to talk to visitors from other parts of the country, other parts of the world. You know, we're a tourism capital. And it's not just because we have monuments. People come here and they get a chance to interact with D.C. residents. And they all are surprised and thankful that they find that the people who live here aren't the demons with horns that have been painted on Fox News.
Well, and you know what? You mentioned our police department a few minutes ago. We have the nicest cops in America. You can stop and talk
trained.
To a DC
We have
cop.
The best trained police officers in the nation.
You know, you can talk to any DC cop or a Capitol cop, and DC cops especially. I remember being in L.A. at the convention, Democratic convention, and asking an L.A. police officer for directions, and he looked at me like he was going to beat me up. Like,
he probably
what do I
was.
Look like? I'm a tour guide? Get out of here. You know, but a D.C., you know, the D.C. police, they're all always helpful, and it's a great city, and the people that live here love it,
And I think we do have the right way of looking at the world. I mean, you talk about our police officers. They are very well trained. And I give that credit, obviously, to the police officers themselves. But, you know, Bernie Demchak helped sponsor a movement where all the D.C. police officers, I think, have now visited the Afro-American Museum so they can learn about the history of race in America and the accomplishments and trials and tribulations of Afro-Americans in the nation. That's important. And those officers want to know that way because they want to serve the citizens. And the way you serve the citizens is to understand who we are and understand how great we are and what our strengths are and our history and our goals and visions and aspirations for the future. And I think many of our police officers are that way.
Well, Bernie Dumchuck happens to be one of my favorite people. And
that's just another thing.
We have all these museums. You know how many people say to me, well, how much does it cost to go to the African-American Museum? The museum, nothing. What does it cost to go to the Aerospace Museum? Nothing. All this stuff is free. And you know.
So much to see, so much for free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I took a course. There's a campus, right, for the Smithsonian under the mall. And I took a course from, I forget who she was. She was like the number one presidential scholar from, she had to, held a seat at Harvard University on presidents, and it cost me $35. You know,
wow.
You could take a course. Yeah, you could take a course from a famous journalist or an author, and you know, pay $50, and that's it. You know, yeah.
Oh, listen, I know all about that. I have been a member of the Smithsonian Associates for decades. And that's where you get a chance to attend the very kind of courses you're talking about, where the renowned scholars who've traveled the world that have seen different parts of life, and for, you know, a small amount of money, you can attend one of their lectures. And now, of course, because of the pandemic, we can see them online for a small amount of money. It just gives you opportunities to expand the horizons of your life. I do believe as we move forward in the city, you are going to see more and more effort made to improve what I call human capital. You know, for years, we used to talk about economic development, and it is important, and we're doing that. But economic development is just a way to give people money to improve themselves, to improve their lives. But I think we're really moving into a new phase now where more emphasis is being placed on giving people an opportunity to expand their horizons, giving them a fair shot so they can be the best that they can be. That's why we built our schools like we have. That's why we're spending money on daycare, spending money to improve the education requirements for those people who take care of our young children while parents go to work. And all of this is because we now have a belief that we want to make our people better and stronger, not just build roads, not just, you know, have more police officers. We want to do something to enhance the human spirit. And I think you're seeing that now in our government.
Well, let's hope that's the case and that it continues, because we're going to spend a couple of years here fighting to maintain ourselves against these right-wing Republicans in the Congress. And I think
we're going to rely on you for that, Michael. You're our senator. We're right behind you.
Yeah. And let me say, Bill, I say this with no hubris. I'm worth every dime you pay me. So
you get what you pay for, and how much do we pay you, right?
That's the truth, unfortunately, often. Well, we're out of time. So at the end, thank you so much for being with us. I hope you come back again sometime, or we'll talk again in the future. At the end of every show, we play a song, and we dedicate it to our guest. And this song goes out to you and every other Washingtonian that gives a damn about this lovely city.
Thank you very much for having me. Truly, it's been an honor. I've enjoyed it.
And we've enjoyed having you. Thanks so much, council member. Here's Nina Simone with I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free.
Hi, girl.
See you next week. Mind you.
capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.